Okay. The story is Till There Was You. Jack's singular discovery was that things are, in fact, as they seem. Keys that get lost, for example, especially those that turn up in what would appear to be plain sight on a desktop, a counter, or the middle of a made bed, actually do cease to exist until the instant they are found. Likewise, the sky is, in fact, a bowl placed over the earth, a pale blue bowl, matte surfaced, lighter near its rim, darker near its crown, or at night, a sort of colander randomly punctuated by buckshot, light shining through. The sky will, of course, sometimes seem vast and immaterial. Often this is only an illusion, the inevitable consequence of the fact that things, airplanes, birds, really do grow smaller as they move away. But if you are walking across a field one night, and the sky should look to you like nothing so much as the eternity of non-being, in which isolate and innumerable instances of being scintillate in varieties of pink, green, and brilliant white, well then, you can be reasonably assured that's exactly what it is. Most people have difficulty accepting Jack's discovery until they come to understand that there is nothing fixed or absolute about truth and falsehood, reality and fantasy, good and evil, etc., etc. All such dichotomies are purely a function of human emotion, of fear and desire especially. When we are content, everything is real and true and good. That's obvious, isn't it? You're canoeing on a lake with the one you love. You're laughing delightedly at each other's jokes, trading nibbling kisses that promise much more profound satisfactions when you return to your cabin. The sun is an oblong of radiant orange, melting into its rippling reflection. Crickets are loosing their nets of song in the distant fields. Who but a lunatic would question the authenticity or legitimacy of such a moment? It is only when we want incompatible things simultaneously, or when our desires smack against our fears, that we become obsessed with distinguishing the true from the false, reality from fantasy, evil from good. Think of the countless grinding 4 a.m.s that human beings have had to endure at the service of this obsession. Think of all the lives made boring, shameful, and bleak by one or another white-knuckled vision of good, and of all the nations and peoples slaughtered because of some truth proclaimed from mountaintop. The beauty of Jack's discovery is that it reduces such hair-splitting, chest-thumping, soul-starving, and savagery to pantomime. But that is not at all to say that Jack's discovery elevates or purifies human nature in any way. Alas, it does nothing whatsoever to relieve us of the burden of who we actually are. This is Jack on the night he made his discovery. You will notice that he is not in possession of the average good looks, intelligence, emotional stability, and sense of humor that heretofore had been his lot in life. His eyes, bulging, asymmetrical, the larger one vein-laced, scarlet, oozing a yellowish fluid. His mouth, also asymmetrical, more ragged gash than biological organ. Posture, hunched. Shoulders, barely wider than his neck. That sinus-withering palm wafting about him, an emanation of the greasy secretion glossing his nose and lips, streaming down his ribs and thighs. Jack's transformation took place over a couple of weeks and started slowly with what appeared to be, and was of course, mild conjunctivitis. He and Grace were lazing in bed one sunny midsummer Sunday, as they had on countless other Sundays over the last 17 years. She loved to waken in a sun-filled room, so slid from under the covers and went to the window, allowing Jack a moment in which to admire her long and fluent oscillations, her sandy pink, her hazelnut brown, and her gold, here tufty and tarnished dark, there lanky and flaxen bright. Grace was not, in fact, an especially beautiful woman. The various parts of her body didn't always add up. And then there was her chin, a mere bump along the road between her lower lip and Adam's apple. Jack knew that Grace was not beautiful and didn't know it at the same time. In his eyes, she constantly shuttled between out of this world and so-so. The truth is that what most attracted him to her was her capacity to ache. Inside Grace, there was a field of sodden ash under a weighty gray sky. The only birds there were harsh-voiced winter birds, crows, and jays. But this field was where she felt most herself, and where she could be found walking during almost any idle moment. Often Jack would be right at her side, his chilled red fingers interlaced with hers, his clothing penetrated by the same dank breeze as hers, his hair mist-pearled, and his cheeks stippled with the same tiny, trembling drops. It moved and excited Jack to think that this woman he loved could walk this field and pedal a bike through city traffic simultaneously. Jack found a deep poignancy in this fact, minor key harmony, truth as a form of beauty. And now, pulling back the curtains, Grace had just gilded the front half, her front half, in morning sun. What could be more wonderful? But for some reason, as he and Grace both luxuriated in the effects of morning sunlight on her bare skin, Jack's thoughts drifted back to the previous night, and in particular to something strange she had done with her tongue. At the time, it had seemed surprising and delicious, but now, all at once, it seemed ominously unprecedented, like nothing she could have improvised on her own. "My eye feels funny," he said, as she made her way back to the bed. "Itchy," he said. "Does it look bloodshot?" She crinkled the bridge of her nose and peered into at one eye, then the other. "Nope," she said, and kissed him on the cheekbone. A few days later, he came home early from work and found her sitting on the floor in the corner of the kitchen, talking on her cell phone. The fingertips of her free hand pressed in a clump against the middle of her forehead. As soon as he entered the room, she snapped her phone shut and smiled at him broadly. "Who was that?" he said. "No one," she replied, her eyes glittery with tears. In that instant, his shoulders slumped, though not so much that anyone would have noticed, and his conjunctivitis, which had been improving, spread to the other eye. A day later, while driving Jack to the commodity spot, Grace began to talk about a movie she had seen and seemed at first to think he had seen it too. A look of panic crossed her face. "That must have been someone else," she said. "Some other movie, I mean." And then she seemed to lose the ability to speak. For a moment, Jack was tempted to ask her what she had been meaning to say about the movie, but he didn't. And by the time they pulled into the mile-wide parking lot, his lips had gone bloody, and one corner of his mouth was slightly higher than the other. At dinner the following Friday, Jack exclaimed incredulously, "But you always hated Brussels sprouts." "No, I didn't. I love them. Human flesh in the form of a tiny cabbage," he said. "That's what you always called them." "Well, I've changed my mind. Can I change my mind? Why don't you let me evolve? Why do you insist that I always stay the same?" Thence commenced the first hint of Jack's ocular asymmetricality. Thence the first waft of his sinus-withering pun. Jack actually laughed when Grace told him it was Buddy. Buddy, his college roommate, befuddled, endearing, loyal, and permanently childlike, the perfect fat guy sidekick to an action movie hero. Buddy actually was a fat guy, but he could sing like Neil Young and played a mean slap bass. In college, everyone had assumed he was headed for rock stardom, but in the 23 years since, he had supported himself first as a clerk in a vintage record store, and then, once the internet drove the store under, as a receptionist in a vet's office. Jack, too, had wanted to be a rock musician, but his hands were too small. "Hold up your hand," his grandfather, a dentist, had told him one Christmas, then pressed his own hand against Jack's. "Perfect match," his grandfather said. And then he said, "You may be a lousy guitarist, but with dinky hands like these, you could be a million-dollar dentist." So Jack went to dental school, and now he owned a duplex loft on Carbolic Avenue, a 200-year-old farmhouse in the uplands, and a pied-à-terre in Paris. And, of course, he had also met cracked molar, exposed nerve, eye-stabbing pain, and fallen in love with Grace. Bunny's romantic life, or so Jack had heretofore believed, had been confined to his one great love, the high school girlfriend who had dumped him for the math genius sports bookie who, after nearly a quarter of a century, still kept her well supplied with BMWs, designer gowns, Xanax, and cocaine. Whenever Buddy mentioned her name, his eyes would go moony, his forehead dark with tortured hope, and he would speak in a breathy, sentimental sing-song. "Jack loved Buddy. What a sweet guy," he always said. But then he would heave a heavy sigh. He couldn't help it. And Grace was the same. "Poor Buddy," she said, whenever Buddy's name came up. And then she'd shake her head and lower her voice. "Poor, poor Buddy." And so Jack laughed when Grace told him. Her face went parrot red. The skin between her eyebrows suffered tectonic dislocation. "What kind of response is that?" she said. "You can't be serious," said Jack. "How did you ever get to be such a fucking weirdo?" Grace said. "What the fuck did I ever see in you?" With that, she was gone. Jack stood at the slammed loft door, its echo coming back to him off half an acre of hardwood flooring, industrial detail work, wood beam ceiling, cast iron staircase, 6 potted palms, a jacuzzi, a hulking 12-burner stove, 4 TVs. Grace had been carrying a suitcase when she slammed the door, and it had her gooseneck lamp clipped under one arm. That lamp had stood at her bedside ever since she was a little girl, in every place she had ever lived, house, dorm, apartment, and had been the solitary furnishing she had brought along when she moved into Jack's loft. A codicil to Jack's discovery is the principle that all appearances are interconnected and that no seeming can occur in isolation. Thus it is true that although Jack's transformation began to accelerate as he stood staring at that door, it might never have gotten so extreme had Grace and Buddy not also begun to change. Before Grace had reached the bottom of the staircase, she had gained at least a couple of inches in height and become distinctly model-esque. As she strode out onto Carbolic Avenue, her oscillations attained that degree of grandeur normally reserved for surges at sea or enormous trees in a strong wind. And then there was her chin. What could Jack have been thinking? Could a chin possibly have been more perfectly proportioned, more chuckable, more deserving of tender adoration? How could he ever have brought his mouth to Grace's without first adorning her chin in butterfly nips and lip caresses? And Buddy, too. How was it Jack had never noticed Buddy's rock jaw and hawk-like gaze? Far from moony or forlorn, Buddy's habitual expression was classical 19th century American, upright, self-reliant, ruggedly individualistic. He radiated exactly that fortitude and steadiness of purpose that women found irresistible. How could Jack have been so blind? These and many other seeming revelations preconditioned Jack's transformation. And as they crashed sickeningly into his self-esteem, he grew ever more stench-clouded, gash-mouthed, boogly-eyed, and asymmetrical. His complexion flourished with moles. He slumped. His head became indistinguishable from his shoulders. His arms bowed and shrank to quasi-vestigial proportions, and so on, until, in the end, he seemed to have been retooled as a toad by a psycho with a machete. Repulsive, in other words. Unlovable. Totally. Fated for solitude. No wonder Grace had run from him. Who wouldn't? After an extended session of misery and self-condemnation, Jack left his loft in quest of the solace of alcohol. But no sooner had he pushed through the swinging doors of Striketown Local than he had to contend with the glances cast his way by the other patrons, even the regulars, with whom he traded weather and sports commentary for decades. Steely glances, contemptuous, glances that said, "What makes you think you belong here?" And, in fact, he didn't belong. So again he fled. But it was the same at the next bar, and the next. He fled, and he fled, and he fled, and eventually found himself down in the rumination district, at one of those joints whose denizens seem to have accreted onto their bar stools out of a miasma born of disappointment, illness, and urinal deodorizing tablets, where every light bulb is dust-encrusted, and the illumination it sheds at least 100 years old. But here, too, the sideways glances, the mutterings, the contemptuous turnings away. He took a seat at the bar, and within a minute, the stools on either side of him were vacant. He picked up his glass, moved to the table in the corner, and that whole side of the room went silent. One by one, the tables near his were abandoned. Even an ancient drunk, asleep on a ripped vinyl banquette, lifted his head, squinted in front, and staggered to the far side of the room. Discovery is the process by which the unnoticed passes through impossibility into obviousness. The final stages of this process generally transpire within split seconds, but the earliest can seem to occur, retrospectively at least, with geological lassitude, or to be manifestations of such monumental stupidity and incuriousness that the historian of ideas may feel moved to take his subjects by their shoulders and shout into their dull visages, "You stupid dimwit fuck-ups! Can't you see what's right in front of your eyes?" It is important to remember that at this particular moment of the night, Jack was not able to see what was right before his eyes, because he had not been able to lift his head far enough above the welter of assaults, disillusionments, shocking revelations, and the actualization of long-denied home truths, to recognize their secret structure and true significance. It would have been easier for you. Had you been walking beside Jack as he left the bar that night, you would have had the distinct advantage of being able to observe how averagely oblivious passers-by morphed into leering mockers at the touch of his eye-beams. You could have watched the empty doorways and parked cars become inhabited by deliriously passionate couples the instant Jack glanced their way, and seen how all the women were heartbreakingly reminiscent of Grace, with one shaking gold and flaxen bright tresses as she pulled her lover's mouth to her own, another covering her lover's face with greedy kisses, just as Grace had once covered Jack's, and yet another, incomprehensible as this may be, rocking back her head and touching the tip of her nose with the tip of her pointy tongue, just exactly as Grace had done the first time Jack took her pelvis in both hands and pushed into her. This was more than Jack could stand. "Fuck you, Gracie," he shouted at the oblivious lovers, and then he began to run. And for a while, he was able to lose himself in the burning, the sweating, the panting, the burning throat, in the way the night broke down into its constituent parts, spotlit bank towers drifting beyond a weed-ruptured parking lot, lunar moth a flutter in pink streetlight, beer keg on tailgate, and no one in sight. Street led to street led to street, like corridors with their roofs ripped off, and the city altered, unfolded, showed him neighborhoods he had never known existed. Ardtown, Illitrodia, Gap Station, street names he'd never heard of, Cream Row, Kicks Alley, Hostage Avenue, street after street, with every window black, gleaming piles of windshield glass, speedboat on sidewalk, vacant bank offices like movie sets for purgatory, his footfalls, slapped back at him off factory facades, his panting went metallic whenever he ran through a tunnel. But in the end, futility. In the end, no escape. Every song drifting out of a bodega doorway or dopplerizing behind a passing convertible told a story of lost love, barroom loneliness, that night we danced beneath the stars. Around every corner, no matter that he'd never been there before, the mailbox Grace had leaned against the first time that he told her he loved her, the stoop they'd sat on, talking about their childhoods until the sky above the rooftops went rose, the fire hydrant he'd run over the day they had their first fight, and always those lovers in their doorways and parked cars, and always those gasps coming down from third-floor windows, those high, quavering, elongated cries. They were Grace's, always. They had to be. I'll stop there.